This is United Tribes News Radio. Insights into Native culture, people, ideas, topics to improve understanding. From United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. In this edition of United Tribes News Radio, Faith Spotted Eagle, Ihangtuan Dakota, from the Yankton Reservation in South Dakota. She addresses a problem that hurts many in Indian country, PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, or as she calls it, red rage, a trauma and anger so deep that without support, it can consume your relationships, your family, and your life. Historical trauma, or PTSD, has been found in Native people's DNA that can go back several generations. This red rage can come from historical trauma, but also the traumas that one experiences firsthand. This combination of anger, resentment, and fear causes behaviors like violence and abuse, a fear of communication, and unhealthy addictions. Worst of all, a lack of self-respect. Spotted Eagle tells us how red rage afflicts a person's health and mental clarity, and also how it affects work environments and public meetings. She also says that healing can happen. It starts by acknowledging the fear, resentment, and anger, and seeking help. Only then can the healing journey begin. In 2012, Faith Spotted Eagle was invited to speak at UTTC Professional Development Days. She holds a master's degree in counseling from the University of South Dakota and spends a lot of her time with veterans and other individuals, either counseling or just being a friend. In her slide presentation of Red Rage, she shares how this fear-based behavior afflicts so many Native people today, and at one point, even herself. She shares what steps she has taken on her journey to wellness and what you can do on yours.
It's been an exciting journey. De ampetu kin yupia kid iushke na pet you chiusapi. De ake ampetu duto wanji uyakupi. What I said is that Creator has once again given us a beautiful red day. Red days are holy days, all the days that we walk in our lives. Extend my hand to you, and really very honored to be in front of the keepers of our survival, actually. The tribal college movement has been so exciting to watch. I taught at one of the first colleges, Sintegaleshka University, down at Rosebud, and this was a long time ago, before some of you were born, in 1977, and we met wherever we could, so it's really exciting to see how far you've come. We met when we didn't have buildings, and we met wherever we could. So I'm honored to be here. What I want to talk to you about is something that is a lifelong passion for me, and it began formally in 1990. You all know, maybe some of you have heard about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I have it. Probably 95% of Native people have it, whether we know it or not. It's not a badge of shame. It's a badge of survival and courage. And once you realize you have it and you're able to learn from it, we become very, very strong people. And that's what I want to inspire in you today. Post means after. Trauma. A trauma is when something happens and your body can't handle it. So your body does some real interesting things in order to cope with the trauma. The S in PTSD is that when we have these traumas, we do things that are very, very stressful, like we drink. We get high. We hurt each other. We perform acts of violence on each other. That's the stress. It's coming out of our body. It's kind of like a pus inside of our body, and it begins to drain. And it drains into our communities, and that's what I'm here to most of all share with you today, because many of you are going to be going home to this. Disorder is when it becomes a real problem. One of the problems that I see manifesting in many of our young people that I've worked with over the years in therapy and counseling and in our societies and ceremonies is many of our young people have panic disorders, anxiety attacks. I was doing a session on calling home the spirit of our language in Vancouver a few years ago. I had about 60 people in the particular workshop that I was doing, and all of a sudden I had a participant who went into a full-blown anxiety attack. It was very, very inspiring to be able to see this individual stay there. She stood strong, and for the first time in her life, she was able to overcome this attack. And I'll tell you a little bit about that attack in a few minutes here after you understand why that happens. PTSD is something that I began studying in 1990. You all are familiar with trauma in our communities. There's no people in the world that love to talk about trauma more than Native people. And you know what that is? Where you have trauma, you have drama. How many drama queens in the audience? Raise your hand. Don't be lying. Raise your hand. How many? We can't leave the guys out. How many drama kings in the audience? Get that hand up there. We see that in our communities. Where you have trauma, you're absolutely going to have drama. So here's an example of how this drama plays out on an everyday plane in a reservation community. The phone rings. Somebody's gossiping. Somebody hates on somebody and does something, and they all call up mom, and they say, oh, Mom, did you hear what someone said about so-and-so? Oh, my God, she said that. The breathing starts going. The phones start ringing. The cars come into the driveway of mom's house. Holy smokes, it's off into the community, right? Nobody's going to talk about my family like that. So we summon the battle horses, and we're off into the war in the community. That's pure drama, right? In the Native community, in the schools, we see that too. My children went to Haskell, and I saw some real hard situations at Haskell. Really hard examples of what has happened because of this trauma. I happened to be down visiting my baby girl. My baby girl is now 30. In a couple days, she's going to be 31. She's getting her master's at University of Missoula in cultural anthropology. But she was the subject of what we call girl-on-girl aggression. Those of you girls in the audience know that there's a real hard thing that happens in our community, and we mimicked the outer culture. We did not hate on each other as women and girls. We're a matriarchal society, but all of a sudden something snapped. This slide up here, in my language, it says tansop, ah. That means to literally freeze and die. So when we have that trauma that happens in our life, it's like all of a sudden we're frozen. And my body can't handle it. We feel it in your tummy. You feel it in your spirit. You don't know what to do. That's what tansakta. Now, just like there's physical death, I myself, on May 21st, 2010, I had a physical near-death experience. If I have time, I'll share a little bit about what the message that I was given when I came back. I still have a limp. I'm going to have some surgery. But I was given the great gift of coming back. But I also know there's spirit death. Each one of us, in our body, we have what is called a sichun, which is the womb of life. In the spirit world, when your spirit decided to come to your parents, when you came here, you came as that spirit with the memory of past lives. And oftentimes, when that trauma comes in this physical life that you're living in, if there's a car accident and a friend or a relative dies, that spirit's going to jump out. Or maybe you get molested or raped. I'm a sexual abuse survivor. As a little girl, my spirit hopped out of there real fast and went to hide for a while. And through the help of friends, I was able to call my spirit back. The message that I have for you today is, in doing this work, you do have to stand in full spirit. Many of you probably in the audience are not standing in full spirit. And so by acknowledging that does not mean that you're weak. It just means that something happened. Something happened in the road of your life, and you got to figure out, how do I get my spirit back inside, because I really need it. I need to stand in full spirit to take on those things that everybody at your tribal school is telling that you have to do. If you're barely hearing it, there's something that needs to happen. And as I talk today, the spirit inside of you, that is the little wisdom, is in your tummy. As I go over some of the things that I'm going to do in this very short time that I have with you, if you feel that little strange feeling in your tummy, in that solar plexus area, that's the wisdom of your spirit telling you, hey, pay attention, there's something going on here that I need to take care of, and I may need help to do it. That's that intuition. In our language, in Native Indigenous knowledge, all the things that psychologists, psychiatrists, scientists talk about it, we had those type of people. Nowadays, they call them professionals. In our culture, we call them wise people. They figured these things out after thousands of years of trial and error. Some of our people even died from testing some of the medicine because I guess you'd call that a trial run that failed, huh? But we did try some of those medicines when we didn't know if those were the ones, but a lot of times the Buffalo Nation led us to those medicines. So in looking at the spirit death, I want you to realize that the majority of you probably have seen it, heard it, or experienced it, okay? I began this journey in 1990. Now, as I go into this, I want you to look at the very basic trauma that we suffered that completely changed our life. But the historical trauma that changed your path and my path was the boarding school experience. We all know that. This is going to symbolize the boarding school experience, and I'm going to put it right here. So when those beautiful children went off to Hampton Institute in the 1800s, the very morning after their braids had been cut off and they put them into these tight clothes and they're sitting there and they're looking scared, this Colonel Pratt comes into the classroom. He greets the kids and he says whatever he's going to say about why they've come there. And one of the words that he said echoes in my mind constantly, and that's why I do the work that I do. He looks at these precious little kids. I have an 8-year-old granddaughter. Her name is Gimiminahota, gray butterfly. I can't even visualize her being put on a train to go to Carlisle. Can you imagine? Little baby girls like her were put on trains and were sent off to school. These little kids were in the classroom, and Colonel Pratt comes in and he says, "Today, the Indian in you is dead." Can you imagine an 8-year-old saying that? "The Indian in me is dead." And then things began to progress that showed them that. So as we look at this, what we have to do is we have to reclaim our humanity. Because dehumanizing statements and very long years of dehumanizing actions caused us to think that our ways were not right. And we all know this story. We all know this story real well. We were colonized into thinking that being Native was not good enough. We even went through an era of time where we told you that your language was not good enough. But I'm standing here as a testament and a survivor of internalized oppression for my own people, that our language is good, and I give you permission to be the best Native that you can. Because when you go home, people are going to tell you you're not. I saw my children go through that. I told them all their lives, you go off and you get a college degree, you come home and you help your people. That's when the hardship began. Because many people say, well, we don't need that white man's education. That's where it hurt us. But we do. We need those tools. Nobody owns education. I can own it myself. And so I began to look at the whole issue of decolonizing, meaning we have to, what Colonel Pratt told you, that you were, the Indian in you was dead. We have to look at that in your own personal mirror to put that up there and say, how does that play out? Here's how it plays out at Walmart. Let me give you an example. So I walk into Walmart and I see another Native over on the other aisle. And all of a sudden, here's what I do. I see them and then I go like this. They look at me and they go like this. Does that sound familiar? Sometimes I'll even go to another aisle to avoid this Native. And hey, they're coming down that same aisle again. And I think, why am I doing that? Holy smokes, I go back. I'm part Sichangu. I'm also Ihangtua. I go back to Rosebud. And I go up to the post office and I see other Indian people I haven't seen for a while. And I'm happy to see them. So I say, hello, good morning. They kind of go, hi. Big tough voice, kind of look the other way. Scary, huh? But I say hi anyway, and go into the post office. We're still busy ignoring each other. And so I come out of the post office, and holy smokes, you know how they say that Native people didn't have eye contact? The way we stare at each other nowadays? You come out of the post office, and somebody's in this car, and you're staring at that car. You're trying to figure out who's in that car. And God forbid they wave at you, and you go like this. We don't even know how to make relationship in a good way. You can bet if somebody went like this in that car, you'd make a relationship real fast, huh? All of a sudden you'd say, hey, you don't got no business doing that. That's the only way we know how, and I see that in my children and my grandchildren, this relationship craziness that goes on. And so why did that happen? It came about because of self-rejection and thinking that I wasn't good enough, so I always got to be busy putting other people down. And so that happens 24/7 in Indian country, and we have to address it. I didn't understand this until 1990. I'm 63 years of age. Back then, I was still all fired up about saving my community, and I still am, but I'm doing it in a different way. I was recruited as a manager in an urban area in this organization. We had this dream team. They recruited all the management team. They recruited the board. It was a dream. We get this huge grant, and we're supposed to work with Native youth. We're supposed to help them attain their dreams. And so we get started, and the honeymoon lasts about 6 months. And all of a sudden, all those same behaviors of internalized oppression, self-rejection, hating on each other started to come into play. Here's how it looks. As a speaker, I can see body language. I can see all of you sitting out there. Some of you are head nodders, and that's good. If I say something, some of you are going to go, yeah. Some of you unconsciously don't realize it, and you're going, I don't know about this one. She's Dakota. My favorite one is this one. I'm standing in front of the staff meeting, or maybe at a workshop or something, and you're talking. Somebody goes, The fourth behavior is a real destructive one. You're in a meeting, and you've all done this or seen it. There's two individuals on each side of the room, and you're talking about something that's very dear to your heart. All of a sudden, they have this invisible communication. This one looks over at the other one and goes, and the other one goes, and the other one goes. They're not even talking, but you know it's directed at the person who's talking, right? Right away, big damper. Imagine how that feels for that person who's trying to do that thing in a good way. I saw that happening in my organization. Back then, I had major, big-time, real ugly PTSD red rage. I'm not proud of it, but I have to talk about it in order for you to understand it, to heal from it. It really PO'd me. I thought, here we go again. You know, I moved here to do this, and we're doing this again to each other. I actually honestly thought that I was the only one causing it. How naive. I didn't understand it. But at that, my red rage came out that day, and I thought, if I don't get out of here, I'm going to knock somebody out. And so I thought, I'm going to take a mental health day. I just need to go home. So I get in the car. I tell my staff, I got some stuff I got to take care of for myself, so I'm going to go home, and I'll be back tomorrow. And so they gave me that look like. So I went out, went to my house, and I was so overwhelmed by the stress of this job and what our community sometimes will do to, we allow them, because we have a choice. We can let that in, or we can just smudge it off, we can let it roll off, and we can learn how to live in a good way. I didn't know that then. So I drove up to my house. It was kind of a dark day in January, and I noticed that my light on was in my house. I was so oblivious to what my kids were experiencing, my babies. I didn't realize they had an in-service day. They must have told me, and it just went over my head. So I drive up, and I see the lights on, and I was thinking, who's at my house? So I walk in, and my babies are in there, and they come back after school, and they're having a food fight. My girl has peanut butter in her hair. The other ones, one has a chocolate milk jug, and there's some cheese. I see some cheese up on the window. And I walk in, and I completely lose it. All that stuff that I brought home from the office, and some of you grew up in this, some of you younger ones, this is real familiar to you. I lost it. I felt this anger, and I just thought, ah! Those old ugly four-letter words came out. I went over to the sink, and I said, what are you doing here? And then one of my kids, he's always got an answer for everything. He looked at me, and he said, we live here? And I said, don't you dare talk to me like that. He's always the smart aleck. And I said, don't you dare talk to me like that. And I went over to the sink, and I completely lost control. I grabbed that pan. They had all kinds of food. There was cheese splattered all over. And I grabbed that, and I hit the sink, and I said, you kids, go on. And the more I did it, I felt more and more powerful. You've all been there, right? It's like you can't stop. You're kicking. You're just, I could not stop. And all of a sudden, I thought, oh, my God, what am I doing? And I stopped, and it got real quiet. And I turned around, and the kids were looking at me, and I thought, I'm a counselor. I can handle this. I got to figure this out. So I turned around, and I was embarrassed. And I thought, you know, I'm emotionally abusing my children. And, you know, it could go further. So I turned around, and I went out of the room. I still hadn't completely gotten control of myself. I went into the living room, and I thought, I'm just going to lay down. I'm going to turn on the TV, and I'm going to get a grip. So I threw myself on the couch, and I laid on a piece of toast. So, I got up again. I got up, and I grabbed that toast, and I went in there, and I was off again. The tests say that when adrenaline goes off in our body, when those hormones start popping in your body, when you get to that place of rage, that thing where people say you should just cool off, really pay attention to that, because those things are in your body for 6 hours. So you can't, it's really tough to get a hold of things. So when people are just popping and going off, you can develop some strategies, and I'll talk about that. But at that point, I was totally out of control. I just felt like I was breathless. I felt like I was drunk. And so I went back in there, and I said, "You kids," and I threw that toast in there. And my daughter, and I realized something. I work with veterans, and I know now, 25 years later, I started working with veterans. When people have red rage or get to that place where they've completely lost it, we're emitting a smell. I can actually smell it. Sometimes when I work in veterans group, in healing groups, it has a real kind of a bitter smelling taste to it. I can't explain it, but I can smell it. And I know that's what my kids felt. You know, if you go somewhere and you're not familiar with the pets, the dogs sometimes will do that. The babies will do that. Sometimes they'll get fidgety around certain people. They can feel and they can smell things that we can't. And my kids could feel that, and it was scary. So when I went back in there, I realized that the kids hadn't moved. And they knew that I kind of was coming out of it. And my daughter looked at me. In retrospect, I am so proud of her. She was only about 8 years old. She looked at me and she said, "Ina, that's not our mom. You go outside and come back as my mom. That's a witch." And I kind of got offended, but at the same time, she was truth-telling. And I said, "Oh, my girl, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." She said, "Go outside and come back as my mom. You're not Ina." And I thought, okay, I'll humor her. And I was starting to calm down. So I walked out of the house, and remember, this is January. So I walked through the door, and as I turned around, I heard a click. What do you think they did? They locked the door. I turned around, I reached for the door real fast, and I thought, they didn't. And they were still standing at me because they knew that I hadn't got a grip on myself. And they were still standing there looking at me, and at that point, my tears just came through. I started kicking the door, and I broke down, and I just started to cry. And they came over, they grabbed me, and they said, "Mom, it's going to be all right. It's going to be okay, Ina. Whatever it is, it's going to be all right." And at that moment, I thought, oh my gosh, I got to stop this. I've internalized things that my own people have done to me, and I'm doing it to my children. That is what is happening in our communities. The oppressors, the word oppressor, press down. In our language, bustag money is the way one of the elders told me to translate oppressor. It means to walk like this. I'm not in full spirit, so I can't stand up proud. I'm walking pressed down. Well, I began to realize that when I worked in that organization, I had to make a choice. Could I survive without hurting my children? Would I have to? And I wasn't drinking, but I was violent emotionally. Things were coming out that I was just as destructive as drinking. A lot of times we'll medicate it, the drinking, the getting high. But I had to make a decision, and I went back to that organization. And I began to have an awareness that I was not the only one. Everybody was like this. You walk around in our Indian communities, there's like a simmering thing of anger. And I thought, where does that come from? That's not familiar. That's not what I was raised in. I mean, I had a very loving grandma who died in 1976 at the age of 104. She didn't treat people like that. She didn't treat me like that. I was a beloved child on one side of the family. So I thought, there is something out of whack here, and I need to look at it. So I went back to that organization, and I told them that I needed to step back. I needed to look at something that I was beginning to be aware of. And of course, they were all happy that I was leaving with the internalized depression. You know, the ones like this in the background are going, yay. And so I thought, that's okay. I'm not going to take that personal. I'm going to walk away and I'm going to study this thing. This was in 1990. At that time, I made a vow that I would never, ever in my lifetime again work for a system of oppression. So do you know what that means? I can't work anywhere. I have to come in from the outside. If I worked at United Tribes, I couldn't say these things. But I can say that because I'm not from here, and I can say it because we have to recognize it, we have to confront it, we have to stand against it, and we have to bring back hope in its place. Because we have become a real mean people because of the trauma and the injury that we suffered in the process of this long, dark winter that we're coming out of. The key word is that we are coming out of this long, dark winter. There's healing occurring in the communities. People my age, I didn't start my healing road until I was about 40. I'm 63. Some of you that are out in the audience that are real young, and to me, 30 is young. 40 is young. You have an opportunity to still do that, and you have to do it because there were some things where I hurt my children, but I needed to hurry up and do it because there's grandchildren, and I am not going to do that to my grandchildren. I have a 3-year-old grandson. This is an act of liberation. When you've been oppressed, we all have to create acts of liberation where we lift off that oppression. It could be sexual abuse, molestation, whatever. I'm going to go over that in a little bit. But in reclaiming this humanity, my way of reclaiming my humanity, because every day whenever I travel into tribal communities, I hear this. Somebody in the audience is going to say, I went to boarding school, they punished me, and I lost my language. And you can hear the grief. You can hear the hurt. And it really hurts to hear that, and it's true. However, the next generation, if you're a child of that boarding school survivor, and if I hear you say, my grandparent went to boarding school and I don't speak the language, at that point, you have committed language suicide. Nobody is standing here with the ruler anymore and hitting you on the head or hitting your hands. It's time for the act of liberation to say, no matter what Colonel Pratt said, I'm going to take that dictionary and I'm going to learn 1,000 words in my language, and I don't even care if the grandmas make fun of the way I pronounce something. All right? Because we are our worst critics. There's broken English. Why couldn't there be broken Indian? What's wrong with saying it wrong? There's always room to correct. But that's what we do. As fluent speakers, we're some of our own oppressors. We learned it, and we're doing it to the young ones that are trying to take your language back. So as an act of liberation, I want you today to figure out, what am I going to grab so I can lift it off and I can stand in full spirit at least about one thing? And you're going to understand that when I go into this continuum of trauma that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But that's kind of an introduction of why, for my own survival, I had to look at this. The first thing was my children. The second thing was that I was raised by a World War II veteran. My ate, my father, was a wonderful, wonderful traditional man. He spoke our language. He did all the things that traditional people do. However, he was scary when he got mad. I was scared to death. And I did not recognize my father, just like my kids didn't on that day. And I thought, where does he go when that happens? I came to understand that he had PTSD not only from our own trauma as Native people in historical trauma, but he also had it when he was in the South Pacific. There were things that he brought home. And some of the ceremonies were not as strong as they could have been when he returned, even though they cleaned him off. And so I'm a survivor of a person who had major PTSD from a combat veteran. And so I made a commitment that I would work with veterans. I'm from the Vietnam era. And that's my special energy. I like to work with Vietnam vets, but I'm realizing that a lot with the combat veterans that are coming now that are younger, they are told not to talk about it. That adds another layer. So we're dealing with another layer. Now, before I go forward with my PowerPoint, I want to build something here to get the point across of why a lot of us are afflicted with PTSD. Okay, this first layer is the boarding school that I talked about 10 minutes ago. These kids came back from boarding school. They, of course, some of them had been molested. Some had been beaten. Some had just suffered severe abandonment and loneliness. Some of them had their parents die. So they come home with this thing. And this thing might be rape or molestation. So when you come home and all of your parents are speaking your language, and you come back to where you left, how in the world do you tell them that somebody violated you and stole your spirit? How are you going to explain that as a little kid? So you don't. You bury it, your spirit goes somewhere, and you begin to medicate, and you begin to drink. And that still happens now, today. And so then, this represents that trauma of sexual abuse and rape. How many of you have a relative in your community that died from a car accident? Raise your hand. That's a huge one in Indian country. Let's represent that. Just take a look at that. What we're doing is we're building stacked grief and trauma. How many of you have a relative who committed suicide or a friend? Raise your hand. There's another big one. Huge percentage in this room. How many of you in this room saw an act of violence take place in your home when you were growing up as a child? Oh, there's another big one. What's another one? How many of you had a parent or somebody close to you who was an alcoholic? Raise your hand. Almost 100% there. I could go on into many, many things that have happened in our community, and this stack is going to be this high. All of you have this stack. So my message to you today is to look at it, because as a former teacher in the classroom, I could see, and I still am a teacher with one of my younger sons teach Indian studies at Marty Indian School, and I go in one day a week and do language immersion with them, and I see that trauma in these young ones. So when I talk to them, I have to be mindful of this stack. So if I come into that classroom and I see this young man sitting here, I gotta honor him, because he's dealing with that every day. If I come up to him and I say, hey, I want you to sit over here, I'm messing with this stack, right? I can honor him and I'd say, my boy, could you move over here? Because I know that this thing here is in balance. It's hinging on toppling over at any minute. And sometimes we see it topple over. So if you don't work on this, the other thing that is going to happen, and I want you to think about this, if you had a parent who went to boarding school, you probably have secondary trauma. So that means that you felt all the guilt and the shame and the ugliness that your parent, they might talk about it like it was a long time ago, but it's in your living room right now. We see it played out about the way sometimes we dishonor ourselves because we think we're not good enough. Let me give you another stark example, and I know I'm going to hurt some feelings, and I don't intend to. I just want to truth tell. A long time ago, we had great, great respect, and that's what we're trying to instill today, now, in the society that I belong to. I belong to the Chante Ohitika Okoda Kichia, which was revived in 1994. You can go on the internet. We even have a Facebook site on Braveheart Society. But we decided one of those acts of liberation that we need to bring back is the coming of age ceremonies for our young people. Nowhere do they get to talk about these things before they enter into the rite of passage that we have now in violent communities. Sometimes is rape, sometimes is early sexuality, that first baby maybe at 13 or 14. Those are real weird acts, rites of passage. So we wanted to challenge that. We got to get hold of them before, instill all those ceremonies before, so we prepare them for what's coming. So in 1994, we revived the coming of age ceremony as an act of liberation in our oppressed community. And holy smokes, did people get angry at us. Every time you stand up for something, somebody's going to try to take you out, right? There were self-appointed people who were going to take us out. But we, thanks to some grandmothers who kept pushing us, and they said, don't give up. This is what we had a long time ago. We need to bring it back. At this point in time, as of last summer, we have 90 girls who have gone through the coming of age ceremony. We did a study, a follow-up study on them, and those girls are different. The majority of them, we've done it for the last 14 years, the majority of them are having babies later. They're taking care of their babies, and they're getting professions either through technical training or through job experience or through college. To me, that speaks loudly. They're proud of who they are. And we challenge that. Some of the conversations that we have in the ceremony, when we only have 4 days with these girls in this very intense ceremony. We challenge when girls get hickeys. So here's the story. I'm on Rosebud. I got a carload, a van full. The girls named our van Tatanka. So I cruise up with Tatanka. It's a maroon van, and I'm full. It's full with little girls, meaning girls from 12 to about 17 or 18. We climb out of the van, and we go into Bowie Store at admission. I walk up to the counter, and there's this beautiful girl, native girl, standing at the counter. Holy smokes, she's got a hickey here. She's got one right here. There's one down here. There's kind of a trail going down here. And I was thinking, geez, this one could use a transfusion almost, because they were like all over. And I looked at that, and I thought, as a grandma, I thought, and the girls were looking at me like, oh no, Grandma Faith's going to say something. Some of them are like already hanging their heads, going to run out to the van. And I said, do you come to work like that all the time with hickeys? And she went, none of your damn business. And I said, it is. I have these little girls standing here. They see you like that. They're going to think it's okay. It's not okay. I'm giving you money. I'm the customer. And it doesn't feel good. And I respect you as a young, beautiful native woman. She said, whatever. And then she kind of grab my produce. And so my little girls were just shamed to death. They were standing there. And I said, could I speak to your manager? And one of them said, next. So I went back and I talked to the manager. And I said, do you let your kids come in like this with hickeys all over their body? I said, as a grandma, I'm really offended. And I'm giving you money. And you know what he said? He was a non-native man. He said, oh, I tell them all the time and they can't control themselves. What a horrible thing to say. My red rage came out right away. And I thought, ah. And so I left. And once we got back in the car, of course, the girls were kind of upset at me. But I needed to see what they were thinking. And I asked one of the little girls, I said, what did you think? And this really disturbed me. This was one of the littler ones. She said, somebody likes her? I said, no. You don't have to do that in order for somebody to love or like you. That's neediness. So I want you to think about that, and maybe I'm old-fashioned. I don't even think it's about old-fashionedness. I think it's about honor. And I would challenge the young men. I have two sons, and one of the things that I have done my very best to do, and now they remind me constantly, they're my teachers now. I tell them, the earmark of a healthy young man is one who respects women. And the earmark of a young woman is one who respects men. It goes both ways. In communities of drama, when they split up, we do not cut up their clothes and put them in the driveway. That is not an act of liberation. That is pure drama. I think the only way to recognize it sometime is to laugh at it, because otherwise we'd be crying, right? It's really sad what we've done. But I want you to remember that honor yourself and begin to look at it in a different way before Colonel Pratt came. Decolonize yourself. You don't have to use each other. You can. I heard something the other day from one of the little Braveheart girls. Made my heart feel good. She's about 14 years of age, and the grandmas were in the kitchen, and we were all laughing and being silly. And she said, oh, I can't wait to be a grandma. I thought, oh my gosh, what a compliment. In the media outside world, it's like being old is bad. To her, it was like, oh, I can't wait to be a grandma. So those are the kind of things that we have to not be colonized about. So this is the leadership response that we had in the old days. This is how everything was merged into our way of life. Ceremonies were present, respect of women and respect of men. We had, above all, a feeling of what the grandma this morning talked about with the medicines, the Wamakashka. The universe at all times was listening. They're listening to us now, today. So we have to watch what we're doing. We don't have to be afraid. We just say, help me every now and then. Help me out here. I'm having a hard time. And so here's what it looked like. Tawachi Wajina means singularity of thought. I read something that made me real sad. I was reading about the buffalo. They said when the colonists first came, there was only 260,000 of them in the colonies. Just think how many millions of Indian people there were of us. Just think if we would have called a halt at that point. We could have, but we could not unify. We couldn't cross those tribal lines. But nowadays we can. There's many tribes represented in this room. Singularity of thought is powerful. So when you get back to that tribal community, when you go home with your college degree or your training degree, whatever you go home with, just remember being in this room, that people support you, maybe not in that tribal community, but do not let them watch you fall. It's going to be tough. It's hard to be a prophet in your own land, but that there are little people watching. There's others that are watching. Those little middle schoolers that I work with every week, they are looking all over for role models. They're looking real hard. And so I want to say that in an encouraging way. The dehumanization process that we went through, it was a deliberate process. Other communities have looked at it and have used it internationally. Hitler looked at what they did to our people, and he began to utilize some of the methods that were deliberately used on us. They did it in South Africa. They're doing it in Tibet. The Chinese are using some of the methods currently now of dehumanizing the Tibetan people. So it's become a standard method of dehumanizing people. And we are buying into it when we hate on each other in the Indian community. They like it. So I hope it's a wake-up call for you, because when I leave here, I did a speech in Bellevue, Washington. There probably were about 500 people in the audience. And when I got done, somebody came up to me. And the reason I want to use that example, because that's what I'm saying to you right now. She came up to me and she said, "You know what? I felt like you were talking about me. And my message is, I am talking to you. I don't mean that person. I don't mean her. I don't mean that one that's always gossiping about me. I'm talking about you." Each one of us have this affliction. And we got to hold that mirror up there. When my daughter was 12 years old, I was dancing in my traditional outfit in urban area. And she came up to me. She had her shawl dance outfit. She came up all sweaty and she said, "Ina, I want to be a traditional dancer. You guys don't even have it very hard. You just barely move around and go like this." And she said, "I want to be a traditional dancer." And I said, "My girl, you can't do that until you have serenity of thought." And here's my teacher. She said, "Oh, Ina, do you think you should be a traditional dancer?" That's that mirror. If anything, those of you that have children, your kids know. Your kids know if you have this red rage. And most of us do. So now we got to figure out, what does it look like? What does that look like when we begin to make that decision? We come to that crossroads and say, "Yes, I have this. And what am I going to do about it? And do I need help?" You're going to have some sessions this afternoon to be able to say, "Yeah, I do self-medicate. Yeah, maybe I gamble too much." That's the new one. That's the destructive one that we're dealing with right now. But that's that compulsive behavior that's going to kill that pain. I don't even want to think about it. And then lastly, do I need to do something for my children and ultimately the grandchildren? So we need to look at all of these. This is what I call red rage. I came up with this because, like I told you, I was going through my community and I didn't recognize some of my people. I didn't even recognize myself. I thought, geez, I have this little niece. Her name is Melody. And I am so glad to say that she has changed. But when she was about 14 years old, she had major red rage. Whenever I'd see her, I'd always try to encourage her. She's a daughter of my sister who has now passed into the spirit world. But I would say, "Good morning, Melody." And she'd say, "What?" And I'd say, "Well, it's a good date." "Not even." I said, "Holy smokes, you're just crabby. When you get married, you're going to say, 'I do.'" But many of our people are just constantly crabby and just out of sorts. And it comes from this pain. It comes from this pain. You go to any community meeting at home, you hear the language of rage in the parents, in the way that we talk to our kids. Here's what it sounds like. We're at this dinner. The kids are crawling around, running all over like they usually do. And we're saying, "Hey, sit down. I'm going to make you go in the car if you don't be quiet. Be quiet. Eat. Hurry up. If you don't stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about. I should have left you home." 24/7. Imagine how a child feels like if they talk to you all the time like that. And some of our kids do. In the middle school that I work with, I know that they're used to being talked to like that. Some of you grew up with that 24/7. That is not the way to be. Honor what you went through. Doesn't mean you're a bad person. Doesn't mean your parent was bad. We just forgot. There were things that we forgot because I did the same thing to my children. But now I have a responsibility to lift that off, and I don't have to be that way. So let's look at this. The definition of red rage is the emotional overreaction that Native people have, which has been perpetuated by the impact of generations of trauma over here, the stacked grief, violence, and oppression of a nation. The thing to realize is that stack, we are adding to it as we speak. There's something that I'm recognizing in Indian country called job trauma. When politics change, without even a thought, some of our young people that dedicate themselves come home and they're thrown out of office because their relatives are not in office, right? We're doing that to each other in the tribal communities. It's not fair. So many people, I've heard young people come home and they leave because it's painful. So I want you to prepare for that because I don't want you to leave. Oh, it's important to note that this is way beyond anger. Now remember, anger is a normal human being reaction. We all have it. But with people who are oppressed, it is like for the throat, and I'm going to fire you. It's not about anger. It's to the extreme. It's to the point where the windshield gets broken. So that's the kind of rage that I'm talking about. It creates rageful individuals, nations, and communities. It makes it difficult for tribes to find common ground for the healing of our nation from this affliction. And I really believe it is an affliction. It stores itself in our body, and it comes out in public meetings. It comes out in times of stress. It comes out in funerals. I was at a funeral one time where people were fighting over the body. That is unresolved trauma and anger gone to the extreme point of rage. If this rage is unrecognized or untreated, it causes unhealthy problems, addictions, and the inability to cooperate. The companion to rage is fear. So you have these two entities walking through the community side by side. Fear-based behavior. Always worried that you're going to hurt me. I can't trust you because you're going to hurt me. Let me give you two examples. How much time do I have left before the break? 20 minutes? 10 minutes? Okay. Time for two stories. So this fear is manifested in how we treat each other. So I go to a conference and I'm at the Civic Center in Rapid City. And I'm hobbling in there with my PowerPoint, my handouts and everything. And I get into the elevator and these two little girls hop in the elevator. And they're just beautiful young girls. You know, they're basketball players. They hop in. And I'm a grandma now, so I have a responsibility to not be mean. And so they hop in, and I say, "Good morning, girls." And the girls look at me, and they go, "Hi." They got their armor on today, like usual. And I looked at the other one, and I said, "Where are you from?"
"Pine Ridge."
It just made me want to giggle. Real tough. They were talking to me, and it just touched a giggle point in my body. And I went over there, and I said, "Ooh, not that mean." And when I said that, that little girl looked at me and she kind of went like this. And her window opened for a little bit. And it's like, oh no, she saw me and she straightened up. She said, "Whatever." And I thought, well, I'm not going to bother them. I said, "You have a good day." They didn't say anything and they walked out. The culture of silence. A lot of times in the old days, in various, very obvious times when relationship building needs to be done, we'll sit there and not even say a thing. We live in the culture of silence because of the fear. In the old days, when we would have tribal meetings, if somebody introduced themselves and they said something, the return, the reciprocation would be say, "Huh, how, that energy would be exchanged. Nowadays, we just sit there and stare at them. Something has changed. And so the reciprocation surprised me. When I was leaving the workshop a few days, the second day, I was hobbling along outside in the parking lot, and here I heard these two little voices. One of them said, "Faith." Sounded like a little girl, and I turned around. It was the very same two girls. They said, "Do you need help?" And I said, "Yeah." So they came running over, and they scooped me up. They got my stuff, and they said, "Where's your car?" And I said, "Over here." So they took me over to the car, and they put my stuff in the car. And I said, "Thank you, girls. You're good tacojas. Really good girls." And they were just beaming. And one of them looked at my car, and she said, "You want us to clean your car?" And I said, "No." I said, "No." But the point is that I made relationship with them. I took 2 seconds to be able to hold them up, and they recognized it. Powerful, powerful thing in our communities. And we forget to do that. We oftentimes will not do that. I tried to do that when I saw some of you young people when I came in this morning to say good morning to you. I used to hitchhike into town with my grandma that I told you that died when she was 104. In her 80s, her and I used to hitchhike to town. And when we'd get to town, she'd see one of her chepashis, her cousins at the post office. She'd be so happy to see them. She'd go up and she'd say, "Japanshi, you piaket wachinka, washte." About half hour later, we'd see her at the grocery store. Same thing. "Japanshi, akeyahi." About 45 minutes later, we'd see her at the stop sign. "Japanshi." Nowadays, the culture of silence, it's like I look the other way. Something happened. Something was broken. I was in Billings, Montana. I was getting on the air, at the airport, waiting for my plane. I saw this beautiful young native woman walking down the hallway. She was clacking along with her fashionable shoes, real beautiful, and she had this briefcase with her laptop. She was coming, top of the world, coming down the hallway, and I felt proud. I looked at her, and I said, hello. She kind of went the other way. And I thought, oh, we've forgotten. We have forgotten. So for your young people, even if somebody doesn't reciprocate, that's who we are as tribal people. We build that relationship. Very, very important to do that. Because all of us have some work to do. I've done some intense healing in my life. I've done acts of liberation, but I still have a long way to go. But you know what? It's exciting. It's not. It seems like work, but it's not. But if you do not start this in your lifetime, by the time you're 90 and you haven't done this, you're going to have to do it in the next lifetime. So I would do it now. Because when we heal on this side, those of us that have some traumas that have committed upon us from people that are now in the spirit world, when we heal on this side, they heal on that side. We know that. That's very, very important. Wopita.
In 1994, Spotted Eagle was a founding grandmother of the Braveheart Society that formed on the Yankton Reservation in South Dakota with the mission of bringing back traditional knowledge by calling home the spirit of the culture. One of the Braveheart Society's greatest accomplishments has been the return of the coming-of-age ceremony for girls that was once forbidden and nearly lost due to colonization. You can find more information at Braveheart Society on Facebook or Faith Spotted Eagle on Facebook. This program was produced by United Tribes Technical College, Office of Public Information, Dennis Newman, Director, Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, Producer. This series is designed not only to strengthen our communities, but to give insight and understanding of a tribal culture and a Native people. For more information, visit our website, UTTC.edu.